This is an ABC podcast.
If there was better lighting on that train or lights at that crossing, Ethan and Mark would still be here today. No question about it.
Families of rail crash victims across Australia have come together to campaign for better lit trains and crossings, a decades-old recommendation that still hasn't been followed. And the huge risks and costs a regional Queensland family experienced to give their daughter the gift of sound.
Can you hear me?
You can hear me?
Yeah.
What's that noise?
Sharing their story to help support other families. I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. At 11:59 last night, Melbourne residents cheered the end of lockdown and the easing of some restrictions after living through the most days in lockdown of any city on the planet. Lockdown may have ended, but restrictions do remain. For example, Melburnians are still not allowed to travel to regional Victoria until the state's 80% vaccination goal is achieved. Like Melbourne, Mildura has also ended lockdown, and across regional Victoria, there has been a further easing of restrictions. It's welcome news for many, but opening up does come with its challenges. Roseanne Maloney is our reporter in Ballarat. Roseanne, Melbourne and Mildura ending lockdown and restrictions easing across Victoria. What has the reaction been from the community as the state takes these early steps to open up?
Yeah, well, overwhelmingly, everyone's obviously really excited. We haven't been able to have people over or inside our houses for a long time now. So, and even though restrictions in regional Victoria had eased weeks ago, there was still that restriction on having people over at home or even just being able to be in a crowded place with more people at businesses. So there is that. Obviously, a lot of people, there's still people that are quite anxious to be going out and seeing people or having to, you know, having people at home or even being in crowded places. So both of those things have both their pros and their cons.
Has it been welcomed by business owners that you've spoken to? What have you heard?
Yeah, so business is definitely an area where there's probably a bit more of a frustration at opening up, or the fact that, you know, so basically a lot of businesses here, even though they can now have more people and the restrictions have eased, things like vaccine requirements that were news that came to them quite late this week means that they don't have enough staff that are vaccinated to even be able to open to extra patrons. And then also things like whether or not they have enough outdoor dining. I know that here in Ballarat, you know, a lot of businesses don't actually have any outdoor dining, or they have very little outdoor dining. So they're still quite limited in that to that 30-person customer limit indoors, even if they were to open up more. So, you know, there is a bit of frustration at the fact that they're not really fully prepared for these sorts of things. Now, there's one business that I spoke to. There's a woman named Elise Rowe who owns the Hydrant Food Hall here in Ballarat. And for her, she is one of those businesses that she can't even open now that the restrictions are increasing, because she's actually been closed for weeks. Having 10 people indoors just hasn't been enough for her to open and run her business and, you know, pay the bills, pay for workers. So she's been closed and was really looking forward to opening, but now she can't. And here's what she had to say about that.
It's not viable. And for us to open for the next few days at 10 people so that staff can work, we're not prepared now. With the last minute change, we're not prepared. So we'll just have to sit tight a bit longer and wait.
That's Elise Rowe there, Ballarat business owner. And Roseanne, what are the challenges ahead now for businesses as customers are welcomed back?
Yeah, so there's a few different things that they've got to deal with now. There's the fact that they obviously have to start checking people's vaccination status, which is something that a lot of them haven't had to do before. They've also got to try and work out, you know, how many people they can fit indoors. And also a lot of businesses are trying to extend their outdoor dining too. But, you know, I think one of the key things for a lot of business owners is just moving around rosters. You know, they're trying to make the most of the fact that they can now have more people, but they need all their staff vaccinated. So they're trying to move around rosters to make sure that they can actually have enough workers that are fully vaccinated to cover as many days as they can. One person that I spoke to about this was the owner of the Forges Pizzeria, which is Tim Matthews. And here's what he had to say about how he's been dealing with it.
We're really sort of focused on staff and customers, and they're sort of two separate things. So the first thing is we need to roll out the new changes in line with the guidelines for our customers, making sure they've been vaccinated and so on. Probably the hardest thing at the moment is trying to navigate doing that with half the number of staff.
That's Tim Matthews. He operates a pizzeria in Ballarat, and it is interesting times for the businesses there as they do open up and restrictions are eased. And Roseanne, how are businesses adapting to these new rules? What are you seeing?
There's, as I mentioned before, there's the fact that businesses like Tim that you just heard from, he's managed to install a massive outdoor dining area, and that's a way that he's adapted to make sure that he can make the most of the fact that he can have 100 people outdoors now. Businesses like Elise don't have that yet, but that's something that they're looking towards just so they can make the most of those outdoor dining caps. There's the changes to rosters, as I mentioned, making sure that they have vaccinated staff on, and even trying to outline their rosters. So Elise, she's not opening till next Wednesday and only opening for 3 days because that's the amount of people that she has that are fully vaccinated to be able to cover those shifts, and making sure that all of their customers are fully vaccinated when they come in as well.
Ballarat reporter Roseanne Maloney, thank you for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thank you.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
To WA now, families of rail crash victims across Australia have come together to campaign for better lit trains and crossings, a decades-old recommendation that still hasn't been followed. They say if the recommendations made 20 years ago by WA coroner Alastair Hope, if they'd been enacted, many lives could have been saved. Geraldton reporter Cecile O'Connor has this story.
At a rail crossing near Young in New South Wales, a memorial and photo board mark the site where Ethan Hunter and Mark Fenton died when their truck was hit by a train.
Just talks about, we'll always miss him, always love him.
Ethan's fiancée Maddie Bott knows what could have saved them.
If there was better lighting on that train or lights at that crossing, Ethan and Mark would still be here today. No question about it. And it's just pure negligence that they haven't been fixed.
As the emergency nurse petitioned to have warning lights installed at all regional crossings and better lights on trains, she was contacted by the families of three young people killed by a train in Western Australia's Wheatbelt in 2000. Despite the WA coroner's finding that the head and ditch lights on trains were inadequate and strobe lights were needed on locomotives, they haven't been made law. Lara Jensen's brother Christian was killed in that crash along with his friends Jess Broad and Hilary Smith. At the time, the paddocks were busy with farmers spraying in their tractors.
When you're in a situation where there's other lights in the area, as it was the night of our accident with a tractor light, we believe that they mistook the train for a tractor.
A train passes near the crossing where the three were killed.
There's no lighting on the side of that train.
The wagon's dark apart from graffiti.
We know with flashing lights that is the accepted indicator of a significant hazard. That's why they're there, and that's why we want them on trains, because they are dangerous. They're the most dangerous poorly lit vehicle on land, and they remain that way.
The families in New South Wales and WA say while road trains are lit up at night, rail has been allowed to get away with minimal lighting. George Smith is Hilary Smith's father.
Light up the train so they could be seen. Look at a road train, you can see it miles away. These kids were coming down that road, they didn't see this train till it was there, about the point of contact.
Transport researcher and road safety advocate Dr. Brett Hughes says the way the road and rail industries are regulated is completely different.
In road safety, trucks are required to have certain types of lights in certain places. They're required to have side lights and outline lights, whereas in rail safety there are standards for train, what's called conspicuity, but they're not so prescriptive.
And he says affordable technology is there to make rail crossings and trains safer.
A lot has changed in technology over the last 20 years in terms of solar, battery, electronics and communications, which has seen much higher quality, much greater availability, and importantly, much lower costs.
The WA Nationals recently voted unanimously to support moves to put warning lights at all crossings and flashing amber lights on train roofs. The Federal Nationals leader Barnaby Joyce said in a statement a review is underway into train visibility, and he met in August with some rail freight industry CEOs to ask them to look at what they can do to improve safety. The families say they weren't told about the review and don't want this issue to be decided just by industry. Anne-Marie Jensen is Christian Jensen's sister.
I mean, in a country like Australia, it's obviously happened here. It's happening in all the other states, obviously New South Wales recently, basically where you've got a lot of passive crossings, you've got no protection at the crossing, and you've got no protection, no way to actually see the train. You know, it's not hard to put a rotating beacon on the top of the locomotive. It's not hard to put side lighting on. It's basically just has to be legislated, because obviously, you know, it's not going to happen unless the federal government actually legislates this. Yeah.
It's disgusting that 21 years ago these recommendations weren't implemented, and the stuff that I've had to do in the last 7 months to try and get to speak to the government, it's just not good enough. We shouldn't have to be fighting with people about this. It should just be already done and fixed.
That was Maddie Bott ending that report from Cecile O'Connor, and you can see the full story on that campaign for better lit trains and crossings on Landline on ABC TV this Sunday at 12:30. But right now you are listening to Australia Wide with me, Alex Hyman. Great to have your company. To central Queensland now, 3-year-old Charlotte Rivett was born with profound hearing loss, and her parents are calling on the community to help other children gain the gift of sound. Today you're being asked to wear a loud shirt and raise funds for an organisation, Hear and Say. They provide hearing technology and spoken language therapy to children like Charlotte. Inga Stunzner caught up with the Rivetts in Yeppoon in central Queensland, family using their experience to help others.
Hi, my name is Catherine Rivett. I'm Charlotte's mum.
And I'm Tim Rivett, and I'm Charlotte's dad.
Hello, my daddy.
Say thank you.
Charlotte,
yummy.
Can you hear me?
Oh, you can hear me.
Yeah.
What's that noise? That's you.
That's the moment Charlotte had her cochlear implant switched on, but it's been quite a journey to get here.
It was a shock to us because we never anticipated that she would have any of these health problems. We found out initially that she was having hearing problems in the newborn screening in hospital. But we found out after some further screening and MRI imaging that she is profoundly deaf in her left ear and will always remain so, and had a mild loss in her right ear. After some time in the children's hospital down in Brisbane, by the age of 2 months, she had a hearing aid on her right ear just to effectively ramp her up for hearing purposes. And for 2 years, she was going really, really well, thanks to the support of Hear and Say, who provided us with weekly listening and spoken language therapy sessions. Unfortunately, earlier this year, she got a cold and unexpectedly lost the hearing that she had in her right ear. And so she was completely profoundly deaf for a period of 4 months while we waited to see if it would come back at all. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. She underwent a cochlear implant surgery on her right side about 2 months ago. Due to the complex anatomy of Charlotte, we actually went with a cochlear implant brand that's very unique to the Australian market. Only 1% of cochlear implant recipients have this brand. And effectively what it will allow us to do is to put a microphone on her left ear, and that will transmit it through to her cochlear implant on her right side. So that effectively means when she goes to school, she can sit in a group setting and she will be able to hear people very clearly on her left side. So we think that given that technology, that she'll have the best chance at leading a normal life and fulfilling her potential.
You don't plan for these things. You really just hope and almost expect that it'll be like everybody else. So the shock and the grief can be really difficult at first, but it's also the learning of the new technology and the new limitations and, you know, all those things. You have so many questions at the start. And for Charlotte, because she only had one viable side, we only had one shot at it. So if we were unlucky and that didn't work, then we'd be out of options and Charlotte would be part of the deaf community and we would be part of the deaf community. But also based regionally, it would mean that our whole life would be uprooted. We probably couldn't provide the resources and the support for her without leaving our home and our community and our families, and very likely moving to Brisbane. So, yeah, it was a pretty daunting decision back then, and we had some sleepless nights. We were well supported. We asked lots of questions, and the medical advice was wait as long as you possibly can, just in case naturally it would come back. And unfortunately for Charlotte, it didn't come back. In a sense, actually, it made the decision a little bit easier because we only had one option, and that was to try the cochlear implant.
What was it like when it was switched on? It was one of the best feelings that you can have as a parent to see. I get emotional talking about it now. Seeing her face, and her first words were, "What's that noise?" Honestly, it was just one of the best feelings in the world.
Joy and relief just rolled into one. There were a bunch of us in the room and a bunch on a video link because it was during COVID times. Yeah, we were just overjoyed with the result.
If someone had said to me, "This is how it's going to be," we wouldn't have had those sleepless nights and the stress and the worry. She has just taken to this technology and exceeded everybody's expectations.
That's Charlotte Rivett, and you heard from her parents, Catherine and Tim, earlier. They were speaking with Inga Stunzner, and you can see that video of Charlotte hearing through her cochlear implant on the ABC News website. Now, there are all sorts of days for various causes and issues, but you might not be aware that today is National Barramundi Day. And in Northern Australia, there's no better way to celebrate than catching your own. Kalyeda Station in the Kimberley is located right on the Fitzroy River. And for stockman TJ Mulligan, he's got fond memories of growing up on the river, catching barra with his family. He took reporter Hugo Rickard Bell for a fish.
Oh, we're on that mighty Fitzroy River, just walking on the bank, hoping to catch a big barra, enough to fill our tummy. First time I caught a barramundi was when I was a kid, maybe 9 years old, and then it was a big bastard too. And the adrenaline rush was proper.
Who were you with?
I was just with my family, mum and dad, and brothers, casting. Yeah, this one big barra just came out of the log. Out of this one snag, I always go fishing. Go at that spot and always faithful, like you always catch barra there. Anyways, first time casting there. Well, anyways, I had this 4X lure casting. And the next minute, this big barra just, poof, big snap, you know. Oof, and then just went, I don't know, the adrenaline just went, like I got a big sock and just reeled it in. Landed it, and it was like muddy. 1.20 meter, my first barra. I mean, proper lucky for me to catch a first time barra, 1.20 meter.
How long have you been fishing the Fitzroy River?
Oh, all my life I've been fishing here. Hunting, not just fishing, but hunting goanna and kangaroo, river kangaroo and wallaby or whatever they call him. And black brim, catfish, especially cherubim, one of the most thing people love out here in the Kimberleys, cherubim.
When you're walking along the bank or in the boat, what do you look for to give you signs that there might be barramundi?
Well, you have to think like a fish. Like if I was a barramundi, I wouldn't stay out in the open. And plus barramundi's they stalk their feed, you know, or whatever they call him. So I would stay under a snag, just waiting for a fish to swim by and just boom, so you can think like a fish, you know. So that's where you throw your lure or whatever you're casting, soft lure. Soft lure come good. And yeah, think like a fish and you'll catch one.
Who taught you how to fish, TJ?
Oh, who taught me how to fish was my mum and dad, especially my dad. I used to go out fishing with him, catching barra. He usually catch barra, and then he always get me to pull him back as I was a kid, and then he just stuck to me and then just wanted to fish, you know. It's good for you.
When you've caught your barra, you've reeled it in, the adrenaline's worn off. In your opinion, TJ, someone who's been eating and fishing barramundi their whole life, what is the best way to... What's the best way to have barramundi?
Best way to have barramundi is get a fire going, and cook them on the coals. It tastes more better, you know. Barramundi on the coals, it's better. Just like how you have ribs on the coal. So everything tastes better on the coals. Fish and beef.
That's Kalyida Station stockman TJ Mulligan with some inspiration for you for the weekend out there on the Fitzroy River on the banks there. Finally, tonight, Queensland Strawberry Growers Association is crediting a pick and pack to win competition for warding off what it feared would be its worst labour crisis on record. The state produces about 42% of Australia's annual strawberry crop with a farm gate value of $435 million last year. Lockdown sent demand and prices crashing this winter season. As Jennifer Nichols discovered, more than 5,000 people registered for the chance to win $100,000, with 2,500 going on to work on the participating strawberry farms across Queensland.
With Australia's borders locked down due to COVID-19 and working holidaymakers in short supply, this was a novel way to combat a labour crisis.
What number? Number 6. All right, drum roll, ladies and gentlemen, drum roll.
Queensland Strawberry Growers Association ran a competition offering 10 workers a 1 in 100 chance of winning $100,000 in cash.
How are you feeling? So lucky and so excited because $100,000. That's a big number.
To be in the chance to win.
Yeah.
Cherish Ling is a 29-year-old from southern China on a 462 working holidaymaker visa.
Packing, strawberry packing from April to now. Still not finished yet. I was packing this morning.
This is her third season working for Laura Wells at TSL Family Farms at Wamuran, who was thrilled when Cherish's name was drawn.
We were all excited, jumping around. My sister was crying. Cherish has been with us for a really long time and she's a part of our family. We love her.
Faced with a looming labour crisis in an industry reliant on seasonal workers to get perishable fruit in from the fields, Queensland Strawberry Growers Association marketing manager Jane Richter came up with the idea.
And when I proposed this initially to the executive team of the association back in February, it was a room full of very stunned fish initially.
Entrants had to sign up with registered farms. The more weeks they worked over the 4.5 months of the promotion, the more points they earned towards entries into the draw.
A huge amount of work has gone on behind the scenes to make everything work smoothly, to make sure that everything has been 100% fair and above board. And I am exceptionally excited about today. Everybody will walk away with $1,000 each, but they might turn that $1,000 into $100,000.
Now, the strawberry industry has come under fire before for its practices and allegations of underpayment and poor treatment of workers. What did you do with this competition to make sure that everything was above board?
So, first of all, every participating farm had to agree to abide by the terms and conditions. And in fact, throughout the promotion, there were two farms that we ended up removing from the competition because they failed to comply. All of the workers who have been selected, we've forensically gone through their records to make sure that they were paid what they should have been paid. All of the farms that I have spoken to have said that this promotion has enabled them to manage their season where they thought they had no chance.
For growers like Laura Wells, it's also meant attracting more Australian workers that she hopes will be back next year.
Yeah, look, I think it was just a really good incentive, a motivation to get people who maybe were interested in coming before to actually get out there and have a go. So, yeah, it's been a positive thing.
In what's been a tough season, with lockdowns dramatically affecting demand and slashing strawberry prices at the peak of the season.
Look, it's probably been one of the worst financial seasons we've had. I think the prices were the lowest since 2014.
For each game, there were 100 sealed envelopes. They had to guess which number contained the top prize.
Good luck. Rip it open. We're looking for pink.
This was Cherish Ling's big moment.
Oh, what do we got? You got $1,000!
In the end, none of the contestants won the top prize. But the promotion has been a winner for the strawberry industry.
It's been heard around all around Australia. We're now looked at as an industry leader in trying to attract people. We've developed great resources through our portals that people can visit now and visit the farms, which is something we're hoping to take forward into the future.
That story from Jennifer Nichols there, and that is Australia Wide for this week. Thank you for joining me, and I'll be back again next week. Have a wonderful weekend and a wonderful evening tonight. I'm Alex Simon. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.